Hello, this is Barbara Van Dalen. Thank you for joining me today on Inner Space. Inner Space is a special program that helps us pay attention to our own emotional health and well-being and the health and well-being of those we love. For today's episode of Inner Space, I sat down with three individuals whose lives have all been affected by trauma. We talk about their efforts to heal themselves and the messages they have for all of us. Actor Sean Brosnan talks about the early loss of his mother and his experience and recovery from addiction. Personal trainer and author Doug Bopes shares how he became addicted to drugs, his experience with being incarcerated, and how he has turned his life completely around. And finally, actor and comedian Daryl Hammond shares how years of early abuse affected and almost ended his life.
I did bizarre things, you know, like my first day of school, the first kid I met, I asked him if he wanted to hit me, because that's how it happened in our house.
All three of these men turned their lives around. They found healing and recovery, and they're sharing their story with us to help others in need. Sean Brosnan is an accomplished actor, director, and writer in his own right. But he's also the son of actor Pierce Brosnan, who is best known for his role as James Bond. We sat down with Sean to talk about the impact of losing his mother at a very young age, his years of struggling with substance abuse, and his new direction in life.
God, growing up Sean Brosnan, if only it was growing up as Sean Brosnan, it was usually growing up as Pierce Brosnan's son. That was the kind of other title that I went by. But I mean, to be honest, I grew up...
You grew up here?
I grew up in Malibu. Mostly? Yeah, in Malibu, California, until the age of 13 when I went to British boarding school, Millfield in England.
Because I was a very naughty boy.
And what age was that?
13.
And I know you lost your mom.
I did.
And how old were you then?
I was eight. So four when she got sick.
And it was cancer, ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
So as the psychologist, it's not a stretch to assume that some of what happened to you with her illness and her death and that huge loss led to you struggling or acting out, probably, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think... I remember being around five or six, and you know, when the illness was really kind of starting to take a hold, having to live with different families for little bits of time while she was in the hospital. I believe my dad was with her, or he was away working. But I remember staying with different families and learning quickly how to assimilate into other family patterns. Mm-hmm. You know, I stayed with this one family, and there were like four or five kids, and there was a five-minute window for a shower in the morning before we all went to school. And I was used to taking these long, relaxed showers, and I was just not used to it. But it was learning quickly how to adapt and survive, essentially. But
survive psychologically.
Psychologically, yeah. In a psychological sense of how do I fit into this family dynamic,
yes.
And then I think later on, certainly after she passed, that's when. You know, I started becoming more attracted to the more darker side of life,
Do you think it was anger, sadness, combination, confusion?
Yeah.
What do you think?
It was the confusion stopped pretty quickly because the confusion was that in my 8-year-old mind was, she's gonna come back. You know, she's gonna come back. And, I never really grieved it when I was little. I mean, I remember viscerally the day my dad told me she passed, and you know, it was like a few days after Christmas, and he kind of, you know, brought me into the bedroom, and I sat down on the side of the bed, and I had my teddy bear, Mr. Softy, who I still have. Actually, my daughter now has him. So and he said, you know, there's a heaven, and I said yes, and he was like, well, mommy's now in heaven, and then I remember, you know, he kind of started to cry, but I didn't cry. I remember not crying, and I said, it's okay, Daddy, she's in a better place. I said something along those lines, and I was comforting him at eight, and I think that kind of...
It tells us a lot, doesn't it?
Right, yeah, exactly. And then, but I think in my mind, I still felt, no, she's going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until about a year later, or 6 months later maybe, that I was in school, and I realized, oh, God, she's not... I actually remember very well, I was walking to class, and... I was like, no, forever. Like, she's never coming back. And then that's where it transitioned into anger.
Uh-huh. So what happened then? Clearly, you're here, so you survived that somehow. And part of that sounds like was you went to London. It was in London, the school?
Yeah, it was in Somerset.
Okay.
Out in the countryside. And then...
Was that a positive experience for you?
Well, it was a choice between that and military school in America. So I figured there's girls in English boarding schools. Uh-huh. So I went with that. So it was positive in that regard. But no, I was completely, I kind of went from being somewhat popular in junior high to being completely kind of outcast. And my dad was kind of at the height of, of his career, really, with playing James Bond.
Was this the James Bond era?
Yeah. So automatically I became a target. And
not a good way.
No, not a good way. And then so I kind of, I didn't make many friends to start for the first couple of years. It was pretty lonely, pretty isolating. And then and then I started smoking cigarettes. That was actually one of the bonds that I had with these three Russian guys who always were in the boys' bathroom, always smoking and always speaking Russian.
Wow.
And I became friends with them. And acquainted. It was someone to spend time with during these long lunch breaks. Where I didn't want to go outside. And
you were 13, 12, 13?
Yeah, 13. 13 to about 16.
So, and again, there's so much, sort of unpacking all of this. That was adaptive. I mean, you connected with somebody. You clearly wanted the connection. And so that was the way to get it. So we could see that as very, you were adapting. As you had said, you'd learned how when you were very little. So there it was again, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But maybe not the best sort of habit to pick up.
Right. Oh, yeah. That was just one of many, but along the way.
Yes.
And
so how long were you there in that school and in London?
I was there till 18 in that school, and then I went to drama school straight after in London. So in between that whole thing at 16, I came back to America. I came back to California, came back to Malibu around Easter. For the holidays, and got in a really bad car accident.
You were driving?
I was not driving. I was in the bed of a pickup truck. Of a Chevy Bronco.
I remember them. Yes.
Yeah, and we drove off a 250-foot cliff.
Oh my lord!
Off of Kin and Doom, great name for the road, Doom.
And you were with kids. Were they drinking?
Yeah.
Drugging?
Oh yeah, yeah.
We were partying.
Yeah, we were partying, and then.
What happened to the people in the car?
The driver ended up going to prison for a year because he was 18. And I think he had a couple of beers. He hadn't drunk the whole night, and he had like a couple of beers, and he was just over the limit. But because it got so much media attention, they needed a scapegoat, they needed to make an example. He got sentenced to a year, and then there were six of us in total in the car. But no one was as bad as me. I broke my back and shattered my tailbone, my pelvis in five places, and
my left femur.
And then pretty much had to kind of learn how to walk again, per se. I mean, the doctor said, he was like, if you don't do... Because the physical therapy was actually probably more painful than the actual accident itself. That I actually was contemplating not doing the physical therapy because it was so much pain. And they're like, well, you probably... You
want to walk again.
Yeah, exactly.
But that wasn't the end of the troubles.
No. That was kind of the beginning, really. Because I tasted opiates for the first time inside the hospital, so.
So when did that begin?
Oh, God. I was like a drug connoisseur. I never really stuck with anything just with one substance or anything like that. Kind of whatever you had, I would take. Alcohol was the one thing that kind of, stayed with me throughout my...
And that was like when you got 16, 17, 18, like...
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, once I was in England, it was, we would get slips for the school bar at 16. Everyone seemed to drink responsibly. That was the strange thing. And I was the only one collecting other people's tickets, trying to get as many as I could. But...
You were medicating, right?
Right, yeah. And then I think about it, especially after the accident, it all makes sense that it really kind of stepped up a notch. And then cocaine was like very common. It was like extremely, everyone was
easy access.
Yeah, everyone was doing it.
And actually, I hear, because I have a daughter who just graduated from college, one heading in,
right.
So I have a lot of connections. It still is here. Quite easy, accessible, in that age range.
Right.
Sadly.
Yeah.
So what happened to you then?
After school, I went to drama school, which was great because that's drinking and drugs are completely accepted in drama school. It's not really, but you know, it's everyone's.
But it's part of the lifestyle.
It is.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Absolutely.
I think
it's one of the high risk factors for people in the whole entertainment space.
Right.
It is part of the culture, and if you're
for
vulnerable,
sure.
You're going to be. It's going to be very hard to manage that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that. You know, that was one of the things where I did really well in drama school. And I think I went into it because I do love acting. I know it very well, obviously. But it was one of those things where I was like, oh, well, my dad's an actor. And I didn't really know. I was kind of aimlessly, you know, I wasn't really good at sports. I kind of was good at sports, but I wasn't good on teams. You know, I liked boxing. I liked doing things like solo sports. And then academically, I was good, but moving from America to England, all of a sudden my history changed the way they do math. They even call it maths, you know. It all changed. Everything was changed. So I started to fail, you know, for the first time. I was always doing well academically, and then all of a sudden in England, so I kind of gave up. So I kind of figured, oh well, you know, I'll go into the theater, and I found refuge within the theater because I felt like, oh, this is my tribe. Okay. And plus, they all smoked cigarettes and drank, and it was just this kind of hard,
a familiar,
hard lifestyle. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I, out of there, I went into the British Shakespeare Company. I got hired to go on tour.
And all this time, you were doing some pretty heavy duty drinking and drugging.
Yeah, yeah.
Managing.
I mean, I was always diligent. I was always. It's always been kind of like I'd always show up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I kind of like prided myself on that, like, oh, I could stay out until we're not go to bed and just walk right in, and but yet still know everything and know what I'm doing and compass mentis.
Which is a really, I think, important part about what was you underneath all of that.
Right.
The, you know, responsible and capable and competent and studied and all that. This other junk was really
right.
There interfering with other things about how you felt and how you could manage without all that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, and I think not unusual, that a lot of people, you know, they're functioning, they're doing their work, and yet there's this other stuff on them.
Yes.
When did it become overwhelming and stopped being something you could easily manage? And when did it start to really, because you made a decision,
right.
you turned away from all of that. When did that happen?
Oh God, I mean, it was really, I mean, I tried to get sober. The first time I tried to get sober, I was about 25, maybe a little bit younger. And that was more of a cry for help. That was like, I think it was like, I had a couple suicide attempts, but that was like the first kind of half-assed suicide attempt. But I just wanted help. I was once again in no man's land. I was aimless. I was things weren't going to my plan. I kind of got out of the Shakespeare Company, and then nothing was really going on. And then I got hired onto an HBO miniseries, so that just, you know, prolonged my I'm good again.
Right.
Just kept drinking out there, but I think the real turning point for me was probably when my daughter was born.
Mm. She's three now?
She's three and a half, yeah. So it was around the time, because my sister passed as well, of ovarian cancer, which my mother died of. And there's lots of kind of synchronicities there. They're both sick for 4 years. My sister left an eight-year-old son. I think they were both around the same age. You know, so
another horrible loss. And
yeah. Trauma. So it was around my, you know, so I had a bit of time before my sister passed. Like I had like a year and a half of, you know, sobriety, and then after she died, I drank on the plane on the way there.
Did you know when you decided to drink on the plane? Did you know what you were doing? Like, was it a, oh, I can do this and then I'll stop?
Well, I mean, the insidious part of the disease is that I almost use it as an excuse. Like, it was almost like, oh, good. You know, which sounds terrible to say, but that's that addict in me going, fucking yes, I can come out.
I can have a drink, right.
Yeah. That, like, you know, no one would blame me for drinking right now, you know?
Right. So you, that was all on the flight.
On the flight to go see my sister. Yes. She had 2 days kind of to live and almost missed saying goodbye to my sister, so.
But again, that tells us how much pain was inside of you.
Right.
You know, that's so powerful, so sad, but so clear. There was a lot of pain that drink then unleashed and led all of that, what came out of you.
Right.
So then she passed away.
Yeah, she passed. And then I tried to pull myself together, and I did. I think I got another year. Like, I went out that time, ended up in the Heathrow jail cell, brother yelling me the whole way there. And then I kind of pulled myself together and then got another year. And within that year, got married, did another TV series, went cross country, drove from LA to Toronto and then down to New York and then back to LA. And so I did a bunch of amazing things in that kind of year, and it was a very spiritual process as well, because I felt like I got to kind of go through the things that I didn't get to go through with my mother because I was so young, and really process it with what happened with my sister. So I felt like it was a very kind of healing time, not through kind of being by myself and yet being with my wife and getting married and then just driving across America. It was just all very free, you know, and it felt
great timing to have the space and time to do what you needed to do.
Yeah. And then I made another movie. And kind of went out during the movie. I started drinking again during the film. No, actually after. No, not during the film. After, actually, the night we wrapped.
So these highs and lows, right? Those are really dangerous times.
Yeah.
But meaning wrap is like, yeah, you know, it's done. And now there's space. Uh-oh. And then, like, losses. I mean, you can see.
Right.
And that's when people are vulnerable. That's when we're all vulnerable.
Well, the funny thing was, I actually didn't see even wrapping the movie. It was like a relief. And it wasn't, but it was more, I kind of felt a little empty a little bit. Just a bit like, well, now what?
Now what? Yeah. It's after the party.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing where I like the consistency of life. So, you know, of like having goals that you can keep shooting for and keep attaining.
Yes,
and
structure.
Structure, exactly.
Yes.
Orderliness.
It's good, right. Which, by the way, that's what parents provide just by existing. And you lost that. You didn't have that. You literally had to go live in other families because your mom was so sick and your dad had to take care of her and his travel. So the one sort of key thing that helps kids feel that safety around them, you didn't get. So it's no wonder that when you didn't have it, you felt, like you said, sort of lost, drifting, empty.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it then a relapse again.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. And then, during that period when I did relapse, my wife was pregnant. And then she gave birth to my daughter 2 years later after my sister died, but it was on the same date. In the same exact time that my sister passed, at 1:03 a.m. Yeah, and then that was it. And then I got sober.
Does it feel like you're done?
Yeah. I mean, it does. I never like to rule it out.
So I think it's dangerous sometimes. People for anything say, okay, that's over, and then what happens if something it's not over? And then what does that say about themselves? So
yeah,
that's probably wise and good for you that you figured it out with not a whole lot of assistance, which leads me to the last sort of chunk of what I want to talk to you about before we say goodbye.
Yeah.
Which is you've made a decision and are working on a plan. You're still doing the movie part screenwriting you were talking about. It sounds like that's always going to be a part of life. But you're also entering the mental health profession.
I am.
That's so exciting.
Yes.
So talk a little bit about that.
So, I mean, in the last year and a half, 2 years, I sort of started not finding as much meaning in what I was doing within the film industry. And what I kind of mean by that is that I like to see things that are attainable and goals that I can hit and that influences others around me. And I felt mm-hmm. that the only other thing that I knew besides the film industry was addiction, mm-hmm. really. So I was like, okay, I think I have a bit of time now. I think I want to start from the ground up. And so I started as a resident advisor, as a tech, as people call them, mm-hmm. at a treatment center. Mm-hmm. And I realized I kind of wanted to become a clinician and a psychologist, just like yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, so
well, I'm thrilled that you're going to be joining the field.
Yes, that's kind of what I want to do. And I'm still kind of don't know exactly in what area. Right now I'm in addiction, but I really want to work with grief and loss.
Yes, boy, you would have a lot to bring to that.
I'm so excited that Sean has chosen to join us in the mental health profession. I know he is going to do an amazing job and continue to lead by example. And leading by example is something that my next guest knows all about. Doug Bobst is a personal trainer, an author, and a mental health advocate who sat down with me to talk about his experience with substance abuse. He shares how, as a child, he had a very negative view of himself, didn't feel great about his body, about his weight, and that he was often bullied at school. Unfortunately, this led to some pretty bad choices in his life. And then he met a mentor in one of the most unlikely places you could imagine. That encounter changed his life.
So take us back to when you were a teenager.
Okay.
And even before, I'll do a little bit of spoiler, this your story has a lot to do with the consequences of getting involved with substance use and what happened to you as a result of that.
Right.
But I want to back it up before that, because I saw in your interview that, which is, again, something really important for us to talk about, there were some things that were going on inside of you that actually led to, made you more vulnerable to or at risk, however you might,
right.
you want to share how you think about that. Can you talk a little bit? So before the substance use began, what was happening to you in your life that made you vulnerable or set that in motion?
You know, I had terrible self-esteem and I had horrible anxiety, depression. And
Was it in something that ran those conditions?
Right.
And it's really important that people understand.
Yeah.
It's not like anything you did.
Right.
It's not like you woke up and said, okay, I'm going to be depressed.
Yeah.
Was that something that was in your family? Were there circumstances, both?
I think circumstances. I mean, my parents got divorced when I was 5.
Mm.
And it wasn't exactly like the most easiest divorce. You know, we were bouncing around from house to house. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of communication between my parents. And then on top of that, I was picked on a lot as a kid because I was overweight as a kid. Mm. I was so passionate about sports, but I wasn't the most athletic.
Okay.
And, you know, as it turned out, I started gaining weight at a very young age and I started developing, you know, obviously some body fat when I was, you know, 10, 11 years old, which then I looked at myself in the mirror and I'm like, why are my friends really fit? Why am I really bad at sports, even though I love them? Why can't I make this team, that team? And, you know,
so what, not, there was a lot of pain in your childhood, some that happened because of what happened, your parents, your family breaking apart. Maybe my guess is people didn't really know how to help you with what you were dealing with.
Yep.
And then compound that with, as you said, not feeling great about you, tendencies to at least either to overeat or food didn't process in a well that it was like dropping off of you, those calories. And so there you were as an adolescent, right?
Yeah, and I just was fighting some really bad demons inside of me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really unfortunate that I chose pot at first to battle that. And when I started smoking pot at 14, I felt like this monkey come off my back. I felt like I could be myself. I felt like I didn't have to worry about any of my troubles or the way I felt about myself anymore. And that snowballed into me getting myself into some pretty deep trouble through the years.
So sticking with that time for a while, because again, I think that's something that a lot of listeners and viewers are going to totally relate to. Even under the best circumstances, that time of life is hard.
Yeah.
It's just challenging. You're trying to figure out who you are, who your friends are, what's in, what's out, where do you fit? And so it sounds like for you, finding that space where you were smoking pot and probably hanging out with people where you guys were connected, guys, gals, whatever, connected right. around that.
Yep, absolutely.
And that sounds like that felt a lot better than where you had been.
Yeah, it just felt good to fit in somewhere. It felt good to, you know, alter my state of mind to feel better about myself, because I wasn't feeling good at all. I was just like throwing myself like a really pity, like a pity party. Like, why am I gaining weight? Why can't I jump? Why can't I, why don't I have luck with girls? Like all this stuff, I just didn't understand, right? Mm-hmm. I just didn't understand. But I guess I, in my mind, I knew it was because it was something on me, that I was a piece of crap. I had bad self-esteem. And nothing was ever going to work out.
It was a terrible, vicious cycle, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was just like I would feel bad about myself, I'd smoke pot. Then I'd feel bad about myself, I'd smoke more pot.
Right.
You know, and it's a vicious, vicious, as we know, cycle you can get yourself into.
And then did with the pot, did that lead you to then try use other substances along the way?
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, I started to sell the pot to support my own habit because, you know, drugs aren't cheap.
Right.
And then
that's part of the culture,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, I liked selling drugs because my phone was always ringing.
Right.
I felt wanted. I felt needed. I felt like I had some power. Right. Mm-hmm. But obviously that was only a short term fix for a long term problem.
Mm-hmm.
And what ended up happening was I met more people, started experimenting with cocaine. Mm-hmm. And then that led to me.
That's a very dangerous drug, isn't it?
Yeah. And I had really bad anxiety growing up. So cocaine anxiety. It's kind of like somebody who wants to lose weight and eat Big Macs. They don't go together. And I got introduced to a Percocet, and that's what really sent me down this really bad rabbit hole.
Did you have any idea the dangers of the opioid, that lane? Did you have any sort of intellectual knowledge, understanding, and or not at that time?
You know, I did and I didn't. I mean, to me, I knew that I wasn't doing heroin, so it was okay.
Mm.
I mean, obviously, I knew, you know, putting substances up my nose wasn't a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that it wasn't, but I didn't know what I know now
mm-hmm.
about how it can permanently alter your brain and how the like the pleasure sensations in your brain, your response to stuff like that. No, I didn't know any of that.
And you probably didn't, because I think most people don't really understand addiction. They don't really understand, if I go down this road, I might not be able to stop.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
They don't, it's just not something that we humans easily grasp, is
no.
it?
Well, no, and I didn't want to because I knew that I just wanted to feel good. I wanted to be able to feel better about myself, and I didn't care what I had to do that. And back then, you know, I didn't think about exercise. I didn't think about eating right. That stuff wasn't important to me.
And they weren't things that you were being told could help you either, right? Were people?
I knew fitness was great. I didn't know that. I didn't understand as much the mental benefits as I do now.
Mm.
But I knew that if I looked good, I'd feel better about myself. Because I didn't look good, I could have been. I tell people I could have been a model for Pillsbury. Like I was just genetically. I don't know if it's a combination of genetics, what I ate, everything. But I was like 40% body fat.
Wow. So this was, and that's such a big place to change from. So
right.
All of those things. And then something really bad happened, didn't it? What happened?
Well, my drug addiction got so out of control that I was just being completely careless with the way I handled myself. And I got arrested on Cinco de Mayo 2008, was pulled over with a half a pound of pot, $2,000 in cash. I was taken to jail and arrested on felony drug charges.
And how old were you?
I was 20 years old.
Oh my gosh, that must have been terrifying.
I mean, when I tell the story, I just say everything, all the bad choices I'd ever made in my life, all the things that didn't go my way, they all came to a head.
Mm.
And I just was, you know, I didn't want to live anymore. I didn't know where I was going. I was hopeless. I didn't know what was going to transpire ahead of me because I knew I could be a felon for the rest of my life. And then I went to court a few months later.
And you hadn't had any legal problems before that?
I mean, when I was a kid, I got busted with stuff here and there, but nothing like that. Nothing crazy, no.
Mm-hmm.
Not as an adult. And then when I went to court, the judge, which I thought was treacherous, was actually becoming my biggest blessing when he sentenced me to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me 5 years, suspended everything but 90 days,
mm-hmm.
5 years probation, 200 hours community service. But he said, Doug, you're young. This conviction's going to haunt you the rest of your life. Because back then it was, I mean, now it's not, it's still stigmatized, but not nearly as much as it was back in 2008.
Yeah.
I mean, pot was like the worst thing ever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now it's becoming legalized in a lot of places. And so He's like, I'll take the felony off your record if you get through these 5 years without messing up. No missed probation appointments, no failed drug tests,
wow.
Nothing.
What a great judge.
Right?
But he was really giving you a chance.
But I didn't know that.
Right, right.
Because I was like, well, I'm 20. I'm high now.
I got to make it 5 years.
I'm going to get high when I get out of here.
Right.
5 years. I don't know if I'm going to live to see that long.
Yeah.
And I ended up reporting in jail a few weeks later. Mm. My life really changed when I met my cellmate in jail.
So what happened?
In jail?
Yeah.
I detoxed cold turkey off Oxycontin in there, which for anybody who's listening or watching, it's like the worst thing ever.
And you could have died from that.
Well, yeah. I mean,
people do, depending on their state of health. You were young, luckily, right?
Well, yeah. And I was, I felt like I was crawling out of my own skin. I was uncontrollably vomiting, going to the bathroom, all the stuff we know that's not
horrible.
So good when you're going through it. And my cellmate was playing Scrabble and he's like, you know, what are you doing here? And I just kind of looked at him and he's like, you know, you don't belong here. And one thing led to the next. And we started developing this bond. And then a few days later at night, or maybe it was that night. Yeah, I saw him working out. And he was doing like thousands of push-ups and all these sit-ups and all this stuff. And I was like, dude, like, what the heck? Like, wow, this guy's an animal, right? And he's like, you're going to start working out with me. And I never thought I could be able to handle that. But that actually changed my life.
How old was he about?
I want to say at the time he was in his 30s, probably.
Okay, so significantly older than you.
Yeah.
Why do you think he cared to try to say, come do this?
He felt sorry for me. No, I don't know. I mean, I think he probably felt sorry for me in a way because he saw that I was terrified when I first got to jail.
Mm-hmm.
I was afraid I was going to get beat up.
Yeah.
You know, all the stigmas you think about when you go to prison or jail,
sure,
or whatever. And he just, I guess he saw something in me he saw inside of himself.
Huh.
And it was like paying it forward,
huh,
for him. And, you know, he trained me in there every day. When I was in there, I started from not being able to do one single push-up from my knees to be able to doing a set of 10, being able to run a few miles when I couldn't walk. And that's what really propelled me, my mindset shift in my head to be like, wow, I can do this. Like, huh, not the push-ups and the sit-ups, but how they made me feel afterwards.
Wow. So you were in jail,
right,
doing that for 90 days?
With good behavior. And I got a job in there, like cleaning tables. I did like 72 days.
Okay. But who's counting, right?
Yeah.
That was a long 72 days,
well,
I am sure.
Yeah, it was a long, like the first few, honestly, I cried when I left. I never thought I would cry.
Huh.
But I was so touched by him changing my life that, you know, he has the workout plan that I still have framed in my place. So I never forget where I came from. And I just always asked him, I was like, hey man, how am I going to ever pay you back? He said, don't screw up and just pay it forward.
Wow. Do you know what happened to him?
We kept in touch for a while, actually. We wrote each other letters and he was, you know, telling me to stop being a wuss when I was telling him it was too cold to run outside at first. And then, we actually ended up working out together when he got out.
Wow.
And then we've kind of lost touch, you know, through the years. But
I hope he's doing okay.
Yeah, me too.
He sure changed your life.
He did.
So then after that, you kept doing that, right?
Yeah, I kept on the path and I lost 50 pounds.
Wow.
And then I got to a place where I wanted to help other people use fitness to change their lives. And I became a trainer back in April of 2011.
Okay. And so I know you've written a book.
Yes.
But are you still doing the personal training as well?
I am. Yeah. I mean, I'm still passionate about training other people, helping people who struggle with addiction use fitness to change their lives. But, you know, now I really like want to be more open about sharing my story because I think it resonates with a lot of people because I'm young and I went through a lot of the same struggles that a lot of kids are going through right now.
Doug's story is amazing. I really admire him for being so honest. I can't wait to read his book. My next guest is also someone who is using his story in an effort to reach those who are hurting and prevent abuse from happening to others. Best known for his work impersonating other famous people on Saturday Night Live, actor and comedian Daryl Hammond sat down with me to talk about his own story and his long road to better mental health after an extremely painful childhood.
I came from the pillars of the community. My father, the handsome war hero. My mom, just a major figure in the Methodist Church in Melbourne, Florida. And our home was a horror show.
Mm-hmm. And you couldn't tell from the outside, right?
Nobody... Well, no, but see, you know, I sort of learned, you know, when you're in danger as a kid, you know, you study a lot of stuff, and there's like a moral checklist. I'm only going to look so far at you. You don't have any marks on you. Your children don't seem to have any marks. Don't see any.
Mm-hmm.
The lawn is cut.
And people...
The house is painted.
And
you have
people
a job.
Didn't ask, right?
No.
Right.
No, you didn't. I mean, I don't think that child abuse was illegal until 1965.
Do you think, looking back, Daryl, because one of the things that we're doing, Campaign to Change Direction, which we launched 4 years ago now with First Lady Michelle Obama and a bunch of other folks have gotten involved, it's public health. It's to teach people to recognize signs when somebody is in emotional pain and suffering.
Does Michelle Obama do this?
Yeah, we launched this during the Obama administration with the Vice President and Dr. Biden, and we're still continuing that work. Do you think, looking at you as a child, if people would have known what to look for, could they have seen that you were suffering, that you were hurting?
They would have arrested one or both of my parents.
They would have seen it, looking at you.
Oh, sure.
What would they have seen?
I don't know. You have to look at the mental mapping. I don't know what it looks like in the brain.
But if they would have seen your behavior, could they have gotten an indication that something was not right in your family?
I mean, you know, I suppose they could have, but I don't know what I behaved like. I mean, I did bizarre things, you know, like my first day of school, the first kid I met, I asked him if he wanted to hit me. Because that's how it happened in our house. You want them to be nice to you, you know, they're going to do something real bad to you, and then they're going to be nice to you. My father never hit us, but he had he was hallucinating Hitler, a World War II vet. I mean, he never stopped thinking about that. You're a little kid and a window breaks in the middle of the night, or a hole is punched in a door, or a vase is thrown against a wall, or your father's standing in the middle of the living room screaming and crying with a German Luger in his hand. That's probably going to show up in the mental mapping. There's trauma there.
Absolutely.
I don't suggest that. I don't know how you handle that. I don't know how you adjudicate that. But probably one of my parents would have been arrested. He probably just would have gotten a lot of therapy, which he desperately needed. But this is, you know, there was an era in this country where it was just, look, man, shake it off.
Mm-hmm.
What? You saw guys with their testicles in their mouth, and you saw Adolf Hitler and saw Nazi soldiers? Stop thinking about it.
Oh, I know. My dad served in World War II, too. So we come from that same era. So as a child psychologist, mm-hmm. and this is I think really important what you're sharing, the mapping that you're talking about, you know, hopefully technology will continue to advance and we can tell. But based on what you just told me about how you were acting, people should have been able to tell that you were not, that you were hurting. Something was going on in this little boy's life.
Yeah, and I don't know what it's like in other cultures, having grown up in just our culture, the Bible Belt. Children were basically shit, and so were women. Like, you're a burden to me.
You're lucky I feed you
you're
and
lucky
clothe
I
you,
feed
right?
You.
Right?
Yeah, you're lucky you have clothes. And I don't think people pay a lot of attention to children. I know that there was a time when I went to this hospital, I believe, I don't know if it's still there, Westhoff Hospital in Cocoa Beach, with abdominal injuries, you know, and internal bleeding. And, you know, the guy says to my mom, "What is this?" And she said, "You know, he got one of those new bikes with the weird handlebars," and the guy's like, all right.
They didn't ask
Can't
anymore.
Be bothered.
Right.
But, I mean, fantasize about a world where a children's advocacy group can go, "Hey, here's what we have here.
Mm-hmm.
We need to talk to you. There's something going on here. Children don't act like this by themselves."
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I used to, you could have seen me on the playground at University Park Elementary School in Melbourne, Florida, teaching myself to cry. You could have seen me, I mean, of course, I would be on the railroad. I used to sit on the railroad tracks and sort of perfect it, because what I noticed was if I was crying, it takes the joy out of hurting me.
Mm-hmm.
So you
were taking control of it.
Yeah, you come
Absolutely.
Home, I'm already crying.
Yep.
Okay, you don't need to hit me, I'm already crying, all right?
You were a smart kid.
Oh, probably at one point I had a brain, but it got a little bit addled over the years, I'm afraid.
Well, and it got, you know, as you said, brains that are traumatized, that has an effect on everything.
The whole thing doesn't work as well.
Doesn't work as well. When did you... And I don't mean like when did you start seeing mental health professionals and then they started saying, well, oh, this is trauma.
I started when I was 19 and no one said that to me until I was 52.
So nobody figured out that this was because of the trauma.
Because until the last, I would say, 10 or 15 years, if you're having a beautiful day with your family in the park and all of a sudden you start shaking and you think you're going to die, or you're all depressed all of a sudden, or you're frightened out of your mind from out of nothing with nothing happening. They just said you're bipolar. That's all they really knew.
Uh-huh.
Here's some lithium. Here's some Depakote. Mm-hmm. Here's some Abilify in case you're schizophrenic.
They didn't know what to do with.
They didn't really know. I mean, they just thought if he's feeling pain and there's nothing wrong, it's got to be bipolar, and that's all we know about it. When I went to my first doctor at the age of 19 in the University of Florida Mental Health Department, you know, the guy came out and he said to me so honestly, he said, "We can't treat you here." Yeah, you can't treat me here.
So they didn't even know where to begin to help.
Didn't even know where to begin. Years later, a flash of me walking into Hazleton, and them saying to me, "I don't know if we can treat you here." They interviewed me by three psychologists and like, "I don't know, you guys. This guy's like a risk." You know, I was in a famous hospital, I'll say it, Sierra Tucson, and I got so much help there.
It was a good place to be?
Yeah, because I went there to learn how to live with complex PTSD and also to be diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are we sure this is what this is?
Right.
Okay, now that we know what this is, what do we do? You know, and like for today, I did cognitive therapy in the morning. I have these workbooks where you identify distorted thoughts. Then I did yoga, boring, but... Wow, is it incredible.
I love yoga.
because it's the only thing that I can sleep.
Yeah.
Then I went to bed and I slept. Then I got up and I took my Epsom salt bath. And then, you know, tonight I'll go to a 12-step meeting. You know, community is more healing than
anything, right?
Anything.
Yep, yep.
Anything.
Yep.
You know, the law of mutuality, I used to research the law of mutuality, shared experience. You know, I was looking for answers.
Yes.
It's more healing than anything.
Thank God that it exists, that people now are starting to say me too, meaning me too this way, not me too the other way.
Yeah.
But that sense of I've been there, I've experienced this piece, and it's maybe different, but at least we can feel the same kind of kindred sense of that pain. Is very important.
The question I would want to ask is how many violent felons, people who have committed acts of violence, did so when they were triggered?
What do you think?
All of them.
Mm.
All of it was attached to some memory. I know when I left the hospital, you know, I wrote this book and it sold well and a play was written about it. Now there's a movie about it. And I remember, you know, my big breakthrough came when I went to this doctor and he said, "You're this way because of something that happened to you." And once we found out what that was, if I could describe the anger, I would say it was nuclear.
I'm sure.
I sure would have killed somebody. I would not random, but my mom was already, you know, passed. I would have killed her. I think so. I think I would have seriously given it some consideration. But the second part of it is monsters hide in the light. Want to find a real good monster? They're right beside you. I mean, they do their deeds in the dark, but they hide in the light. And we just go, this guy seems to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to be a good guy, you know? The third is that monsters don't make themselves.
Nope.
And the fourth is, to be a monster, first you have to be a victim.
As always, I want to give a special thanks to my team at DCP Entertainment for making this important show possible. And I want to thank my special guests, Sean Brosnan, Doug Bopes, and Daryl Hammond. Some of the stories you heard today may have been difficult to listen to. They're painful. Sadly, many of us have experienced trauma in our lives, but the good news is healing is possible, recovery is possible, help is possible. I want to thank my guests for sharing their stories because by sharing our stories, we can touch each other, reach each other with important information and help. Thank you again for listening to Inner Space. And of course, please follow me on Twitter at @BVandalen. Please use hashtag InnerSpace on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. And please share your journey with us about emotional well-being. See you next time on Inner Space.